Coming up today, Snapchat's billions, SpaceX's moon mission, and all the big news from Mobile World Congress. You're listening to episode 307 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Oliver Franklin Wallace.
Hello.
Hello. Let's start right away with a thing you learned this week. Matt, you go first.
I learned that the world's biggest music concert attended by dogs had 1,000 dogs there, and it took place in Australia in 2010.
Was this a uniform breed of dogs or multiple types of dogs?
I think all dogs were welcome.
All dogs welcome. That's what we like to hear.
What was the concert?
I can't fully tell you what that is.
Just white noise.
I can tell you that Laurie Anderson, the composer, wrote it, but I can't remember what the actual song was. But it was called Music for Dogs, so it's specifically designed and composed for a dog audience.
Wonderful. I learned
that's so much better than other facts.
Yeah, ours are more straight. 1.3 billion people in China now use wireless phone services, according to the country's Ministry of Industry and Information Technology. The significant thing being that that figure has doubled since 2008. So like a lot of things in China, the growth is crazy. Ollie, what did you learn?
I learned that Evan Spiegel, the CEO of Snap Inc., this week made $5 billion from their IPO, which is what we're going to be discussing later. But, you know,
$5 billion just to sit still.
Congrats, Evan.
Yeah, he's done all right. How old is he? 27?
Yeah, he's about my age, which is, you know, not a source of resentment in the slightest.
Wired Health is next week on Thursday. Tickets are still on sale. We've got Dame Sally Davis, the Chief Medical Officer for England at the Department of Health, Peter Piot, microbiologist and co-discoverer of the Ebola virus, Jeremy Freeman, Science Officer at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and Jessica Megger, the Chief Financial Officer at Verily, which is Alphabet Google's medical arm, and lots of others. To find out more, go to wired.co.uk/event/wired-events. Sorry, our URLs are confusing. To find out more and to get your ticket, we'll all be there, so you can meet us as well. It is absolutely fantastic. We're very excited for it. Our first story this week, as Oliver Franklin Wallace just hinted, is Snapchat. It's the biggest tech story of the week and probably one of the biggest IPOs in the history of tech. Matt, tell us about it.
So Snapchat, do you guys use it?
I have it. I'm not a regular user, but I snap from time to time.
My partner's addicted, so I sort of get sucked into its vortex every so often.
I've seen you with a dog face filter.
Yeah.
I guess for people who don't know what Snapchat is, I imagine most people do, but just in case people don't know what the app is, it is an app which you can send disappearing messages, put filters onto photos, send videos, really short messages to friends, not so much strangers. It's more just meant for the people that you know, and also connect with brands and lots of other content. And this week it's had its initial public offering in the US. So basically the company has gone public and people have been able to buy shares for the first time. And
so run us through the numbers. So what was it? A lot of analysts expected it to go for about $10 a share, but that was way off.
So in the end, yesterday, it closed its sales at $24.48 per share, and it sold around 200 million shares yesterday. The high point was $26.05 per share, and this leaves the company with a value of $28.33 billion.
And when the stock market closed on Wednesday, they'd put it on at around $17 a share. So between it closing and the next morning opening, it had gone up by something ridiculous. I can't even do the maths.
It started around, I think the initial estimates were around $14 per share. So that's around $10 extra a share that it ended up closing on. But yesterday, it had a value increase of $9 billion on its valuation in one day of trading. And obviously, this is a big deal because the company has been very disruptive. We don't like that word, obviously, but there is no way to say anything different about what Snapchat's done. The medium of its disappearing messages and content that doesn't exist for more than 24 hours has permeated into Facebook. They're developing their own things. WhatsApp has its own stories, which is the format that that Snapchat created.
It is the social network more than any others that all of the perhaps better known or more widely used social networks copy. So Twitter takes elements of it, WhatsApp, Facebook, obviously Facebook owns WhatsApp and Instagram, but Facebook is forever copying Snapchat. But this is a phenomenal valuation for a company.
I think it's really interesting because Snap have... they've kind of pivoted into calling themselves a camera company now. So you may have heard of Spectacles, their camera-containing kind of lenses that they sell in the US. I'm not even sure if you can get them here in the UK, but they sold out on the day that they were released. And Snap's argument is that they are the camera company that's going to power the camera in your phone as a platform, which is all very well, but we'll see kind of how that works. And as you point out, like, everyone's rushing to kind of pick up on what they've done and copy them in various different ways, which is kind of interesting.
But there's a trend here, and it's kind of proving slightly controversial, this valuation. There was a guy from a big ad agency on the radio this morning who was explaining that none of these companies really know how to make money, or that they're certainly not very good at it. Facebook has started to get very good at it, but Snapchat, not so much. And you looked at these numbers as well, Matt.
Yeah, so when it actually filed for its IPO, I think this was back in February, it was. This was the sort of first time that we've really seen a lot of financial details about the company, because obviously being private before, it doesn't have to publish its annual revenues or quarterly revenues to its investors. So when it came out and said, we're going to go public, it started to give us the sort of first real details of its of what money it was taking, and it hasn't actually made any profit at all so far. In, I think it was formed in around 2012, I think Snapchat started. That's off the top of my head. No, 2011 even. And in 2016, it had a net loss of $515 million, which is a lot of money, really.
We should contextualize that by adding that many, many large Silicon Valley tech companies kind of make very large losses for various kind of accounting reasons, and they will say that they're growing very rapidly,
and
therefore
it
doesn't matter.
In fairness, they are. So it has 158 million daily active users, and revenue grew by almost 600% last year, but then Snapchat's argument would be, well, the revenue grew, the profits didn't grow with it, because we reinvested that revenue into building the platform, into building monetization, ways to make money from these 158 million people who are going to the app every single day. 2.5 billion snaps are created in the app every day. And without wanting to get too much into marketing speak, that's the kind of engagement, it's the eye time that people are spending looking at Snapchat that is potentially advertising gold, but $200 a user is what this its current valuation puts it at. I'm not sure if I'm worth $200 to anyone.
That's also, I think, more than double the value of Facebook per user. And I think that's, you know, they're going to have to back that up pretty thoroughly over the coming months and years, because that is, as you say, a huge amount. And if you can actually, we've yet to see if they can actually monetize the behavior. The key thing that they have in their arsenal with Snap is like millennials, you know, that marketing advertising buzzword. The age group is you know, primarily teenagers and people in their early 20s. So if they can kind of portray themselves as the platform to monetize that audience, then they're going to have advertisers and marketing agencies and things knocking on their door forever.
But we all know from experience that millennials, great as they are as some sort of thing to monetize, are notoriously fickle. If Snapchat does something that they don't like, or another alternative comes along, they don't necessarily have any loyalty to the idea of Snapchat as a brand and as a company. They'll be like, oh no, that's pretty good, I'm going to go over here now, and they'll just be gone, right? And that'll be it.
And that's something that actually Snap recognized in its IPO filings. It said that millennials and its current users may be less brand loyal. That was like directly said in their thing. But there were some interesting stats actually that it self-produced. Obviously, it's producing these stats and publishing them to boost its valuation and the price, which obviously worked. But it said that in the last 3 months of 2016, Snap users under 25 and older, sorry, opened the app 12 times a day and spent 20 minutes on the app each day, whereas those under 25 used it more than 20 times a day and spent 30 minutes on it a day, which
they spent 50% more time in the app and opened it twice as much.
Yeah, and I think that's cutting down that millennial sort of age gap age gap of around 18 to 34. So it's sort of in the middle, but it shows the sort of generational difference between the two. And I think that, as we've said, like the one of the biggest things is going to be if it can make money and if it can. And I think there's a slight sign that it's on the right track, because in 2016, it says it had $404 million US dollars in advertising income, compared to the year before, which was $58 million million dollars.
Growth.
It remains to be seen. Everyone got very excited about Twitter. It was, you know, its valuation put it way too high, and since it's just kept on crashing and crashing and crashing and crashing.
Yeah, there's been a few large tech IPOs that have had that. I'm thinking of Groupon as well, where you kind of, there's a lot of buzz around the initial launch, and then the kind of price has fallen from its from initial high. For me, the kind of insane thing about the Snap IPO is that, and this is reportedly, but according to Snapchat's own filings and to some of the financial press, this is the first US IPO where the people buying the individual shares get no voting rights at all. They have sold these shares and surrendered zero voting power.
So as well as being worth $5 billion, Evan Spiegel also keeps complete control
over
his company. Nicely done. We'll leave it there. Our second story this week is one of the biggest video game launches of the year, and something that has meant that I've not seen very much of other human beings this week. Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild is the Nintendo Switch's potentially only major launch game, certainly the only recognizable name in the launch lineup. The embargo on reviews broke a couple of days ago, so I can now talk about it. Myself and Matt Cammon have been playing it relentlessly, and I can safely say that it is brilliant. It is an absolutely fantastic game.
This might be the most exciting news of the week.
Yes, it certainly got me excited and an awful lot of other people. And Twitter is abuzz with people that are finally getting the game. The general public can now go off and play it. And what Matt and I have found when we've been playing it is that we both have completely different experiences. So for the first time, this is a truly open world Zelda. It's getting away from that format of go to a dungeon, get a new weapon, fight a boss, defeat the boss, repeat 8 times, go fight Ganon, win the game, and enjoy it, but quite formulaic. Now, within reason, you can go and fight Ganon straight away in your underpants. You don't even have to go and get any weapons other than what you're given at the start of the game and what you find lying around. So it's very much building on what an awful lot of other game developers have been doing for a very long time, and that people thought, oh, well, Nintendo's probably never going to do that. But it just turned out that it was watching and waiting and is now ready to make its move into these new, bigger, more ambitious open world games. And it works absolutely spectacularly.
I think the thing that talking to you and Matt about it in the office, you know, we talked about the fact that Nintendo, the classic Zelda games, Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask and things, they are all about these, you know, perfectly curated experiences where you're directed down and the puzzles are all brilliantly kind of designed. But And like, how was that going to translate to this huge open world? But it seems like they've just done that in a way that most companies, you know, would struggle to. Like, I've never seen anyone quite so excited about wandering around a large field as you have been this week.
Well, what's quite weird about it, I mean, there's definitely an element of nostalgia, and Nintendo's spoken to this. It said, yeah, we put in these areas that you'll recognize and these characters that you'll know, and there are elements of the plot that you'll go, aha, I remember that from 20 years ago or whatever. But what they've also managed to do is take the magic of Zelda, that it's essentially a series of mechanics and puzzles, and spread that out over a much larger map without it feeling like it is mechanical and that it is a series of puzzles. So the world becomes a puzzle. A mountain is now a puzzle. How do you get over it? How do you get to it? And there are ingenious ways of using the weapons and items at your disposal of exploring the landscape, unlocking new secrets, finding new areas, new villages, and new challenges. So I found something that Matt hadn't found at all, which had completely changed the way I played the game. He's yet to find it, and I'm not going to tell him where it is.
Can I admit to something?
Go on.
It might get me kicked off this podcast and maybe even fired from this job, but I've never played a Zelda game at all.
Get out.
Leave.
Get out.
Leave now.
I'm going.
No, you're not leaving.
Is this something that I could play as a complete newbie to it? Do you have to have a Zelda knowledge? Is it something you can literally pick up and begin with?
I think what's quite neat about it, and we should say it's available for the Wii U and the Nintendo Switch, but it will feel like quite a different game graphically, and both in terms of how both in terms of the graphics and how you'll play it. it's a home console game. It looks great on a big screen, but when you lift up the Switch and take it with you, I took mine to Mobile World Congress and sat on the flight for 2 hours there and 2 hours back, and most of the evenings in my hotel room, social as I am, playing Zelda. And the nice thing about that, particularly on the flight, is that you've maybe just got a couple of hours, or maybe you just got 20 minutes on a bus, but because the game is all of these little puzzles and challenges, and you might just be going around a mountain mining diamonds and other precious metals and things like that, you don't need to be particularly invested in it. You can just sort of wander around, swing a hammer around, chop down a few trees, do a bit of gardening and housekeeping, and then put it into standby and chuck it back in your pocket or your bag or whatever, and on you go. Whereas before, it kind of felt like games of this scale, you had to really get invested into them for a very long period of time. And if you left them at certain points, you'd lose your flow. You'd lose the track of where you were. You'd forget where things were on the map. Whereas in this one, everything is so vast that it kind of doesn't matter. You just sort of explore it in a different way. So a really good example of that is there's an item called Korok seeds, and you find them scattered all across the environment in weird little, not even puzzles, they're like micro puzzles. So there'll be a pile of leaves or a circle of rocks with one rock missing. Sweep away the pile of leaves, you'll find a Korok seed. Put another rock into the circle will be complete, and you'll find a Korok seed. And it's surely Nintendo did it at random. They didn't have someone saying, okay, we're going to put one of these here. There's hundreds of them. And we're going to put one of these on this mountain. We're going to put one of these next to this lake, etc. So it isn't random, but it feels random. It feels like you're exploring a world that is wild, as the name of the game suggests. And that's a really difficult thing to do in a game without it feeling like it's being constructed and that you're part of some sort of mechanism. And that's the magic that Nintendo's managed to achieve. And it's really astounding. And everyone seems to be in agreement that it's bleeding good.
And I think it's going to sell an awful lot of Switches.
Yeah, despite costing £60. That's the, yeah. For a cartridge that is so small, it costs so very much money.
How much lifetime do you think there is in the game?
You could probably get through the main game in about 20 hours, maybe a little less, if you were to just go. So there's the main plot that you can follow and sort of the main quests that you can just do them and you'll be fine, and you'll probably collect items that are powerful enough to defeat the final boss. But I did the first main quest activity about 10 days ago, a week ago, and I haven't touched it since. I've been going and catching chickens and climbing mountains and trying to find food and hunting wild pigs. And
what about in the game? What have you been doing there?
Yeah, haha. there are no wild pigs in Streatham, South London, I am afraid. So it is. It's a brilliant, brilliant game. And it remains to be seen if it will sell a lot of Switches. But it kind of needs to, because there's not an awful lot else on day one that has that real mega, mega power of the Zelda franchise. And Nintendo needs that. You can play most other games on most other consoles these days. Nintendo still has Zelda, it still has Mario, so they really need to make them great, and they have.
And if you've got a Switch and are digging into Zelda and want to talk to James about it, hit us up on Twitter.
Please do.
We'll be interested in hearing your thoughts.
It's the funnest thing about it, genuinely, chatting to someone else about what they found in the game. And up until now, I've only had Matt Cameron for company, so please do, as Ollie says, hit me up. I'm at Jay Temperton. Our third story is a bit of a change of tact. SpaceX.
Yeah, so it seems like a long time ago in this week of kind of crazy tech news, but you may have heard that SpaceX is going to the moon. It's one small step for space exploration, but one giant leap for Elon Musk's space company.
And for commercial space.
And for commercial space exploration. So SpaceX announced this week that they have had some interest, some commercial interest, and they've signed some a contract with two individuals to send them around the moon, not on the moon, but around the moon, and they're hoping to do this in 2018.
So who gets to go? Who are the lucky two?
They won't tell us yet.
This is intriguing. Why won't they tell us?
All we know is that they're high value individuals with the kind of, and they've paid a substantial deposit.
It would have to be a very substantial deposit to go to the moon and back.
Well, yeah. If you know, if you have ever kind of inquired about how much the Virgin space flights and the various other different private space companies just to get out of our atmosphere, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. So to go to the moon, I imagine it costs a pretty penny.
Yeah. And as I understand it, maybe the reason that they haven't told us yet is there's a chance that these people won't get to go because they might not be fit enough. They might not pass.
Yeah, there are various different examinations. Health checks and things, yeah.
Yeah. So once that's completed, which I think will be in a few months' time, we'll inevitably have this big unveil, and it will turn out to be maybe, I don't know, Mark Zuckerberg.
Who knows? I wouldn't want to speculate. But I mean, there's a few things. There are a few big question marks about this still. So SpaceX, the plan is to use the Dragon 2 capsule, which is what SpaceX has used for some time, and that's kind of fairly robust. The big question mark is that this trip will involve using the Falcon Heavy rocket, which SpaceX hasn't even tested yet, and that's due. They say they're going to start testing it this summer. But there's a long list of hurdles for them to overcome with that. And if you're kind of more cynically minded, then the SpaceX's projects have some history of coming a little bit later than they initially say.
And of blowing up.
Just because it's so complicated. Well, there is that. But it is, I mean, it's an amazing statement of intent. Whether it will actually happen in 2018 will remains to be seen.
But you mentioned Virgin Galactic, and we've seen Richard Branson get his fingers stung or burnt, or whatever the phrase is, in a similar way, saying we're going to be launching commercial space flight in, I think it was 2015 originally or something like that, and he ended up looking pretty stupid, especially when, very tragically, one or two of his pilots died in a test flight.
Yeah, that was a good couple of years ago now, and they've only just resumed test flying this spring, essentially. So... any kind of tiny setback, and we saw this with SpaceX launches recently, they have knock-on effects. So it only takes one little thing to set this back by months or potentially years.
Yeah.
But I think that it's fair to say that this is probably going to happen at some point. SpaceX's kind of killer app in this in that they've got both the support of NASA through the through their kind of commercial crew program, which is letting private companies take people up to the space station and then to the moon. And the second thing is that they've got the support of Donald Trump. You know, Elon Musk has talked about meeting with Trump. Trump mentioned space and space exploration in both his inaugural address and in his address to Congress recently.
The way he speaks about it is very intriguing. So under Obama, NASA's priorities seem to be building a space station either on the moon or further out of Earth's orbit as a launch pad for deep space missions, manned deep space missions to Mars and potentially the moons of Saturn and Jupiter and potentially even further within the next few hundred years. That might not now happen because Trump seems to have much of a low Earth, near Earth focus, which is good news for SpaceX.
Yeah, so I think that will probably still happen, but I think that there's some recognition and from the Trump administration, probably influenced by people like SpaceX, that the moon and low Earth orbit is the kind of going to be the launch pad for deep space. So it's interesting that the Google Lunar X Prize, which is a private race to land a lunar rover on the moon, is due to, the deadline for that is this December. So we should see some other private companies trying to do private moon exploration possibly this year. Next year, you know, SpaceX are talking about this lunar mission. So there's some recognition that private enterprise commercial exploitation of the moon, you know, it seems pretty imminent, and that could open up some really interesting further developments down the line.
The space race is back on.
It's fully back on.
I think China wants to go back to the moon, or to the moon for the first time for them next year as well.
Yeah, so you've got private companies and now very rapidly developing economies. China and India, Japan's doing much more space exploration work, albeit robotically. It's very, very exciting, and it remains to be seen how successful all of these missions are. But we could see a private mission landing on the moon within the next few months, and we could see private space tourists taking a trip to the dark side of the moon and back within the next year, which is ludicrous.
Totally. But you know, if anyone can make it so, then it's probably Elon Musk, and with NASA's backing, the timeline may be a little bit optimistic if you want to be kind of cautious about it, but it does seem like this may happen pretty soon, and that's exciting.
The sky is the limit. That's so cheesy.
I made a Neil Armstrong gag. So
yeah. I sort of followed you there and failed. I spent the early half of this week at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. For the uninitiated, this is the world's biggest convention of mobile phone technology companies' announcements. All the big guns are there, apart from Apple, who have never gone, I don't think. And so it's where we find out what the likes of Samsung and HTC and LG and now Nokia and Sony are going to be doing with their smartphones over the next year or so. It wasn't a great year. Everyone at these sort of trade show asks you, "Say, you're having a good Congress, you're having a nice time. What's really caught your eye?" And you become a bit tired of it. But by the end, you sort of get a stock answer. My stock answer was that there are really good big years when a couple of companies come along and make major announcements, and everyone goes, "Ooh!" So VR would have been that last year. And now this year, every company's gone, "Ah, yeah, VR, cool. We'll copy that." So every single stand had a VR demo. A lot of the phone upgrades were very iterative, and the fact that the biggest story of Mobile World Congress 2017, and I asked pretty much every journalist I bumped into, "What's your most popular story on your site right now?" Nokia 3310. This is a 17-year-old smartphone remake.
It's also, can we just say this, because I, like many people, was excited and intrigued by the Nokia 3310 relaunch, only to find out that it's a lie. It's not really the Nokia 3310 that you knew and loved
Yeah, it remains unclear exactly what happened here, whether sort of the rumors started to appear online and Nokia wasn't doing this and then went, "Ooh, but we do have this phone that we could kind of tweak a bit and rebrand and call a Nokia 3310. But it kind of looks a bit similar. It's very dinky. It's almost pebble-like. Very smooth, nicely designed. But the crux of it is that it can only make calls, send text, play Snake, and show very, very, very basic web pages very, very, very slowly. It doesn't have 3G. It's got 2.5G. It doesn't work on some spectrum bands that are used around the world, so you can only use it in certain countries. And in a lot of countries, the spectrum it uses is being turned off.
It costs 40 quid as well, doesn't it?
It costs, I think £49 or €49.
Wow.
So it's not cheap. Nokia or...
No, you can get smartphones for that.
Yeah, exactly. Nokia, or the company that now owns the license to make Nokia phones, continues to make these kind of phones. It's just it doesn't have loads of press around them, and they sell them by the million. The best-selling operating system for phones in the world is not iOS, is not Android. It's... whatever the operating system that runs Nokia phones is called, which the name of which escapes me now. So HMD, the Finnish company that now owns the license to sell Nokia phones, and this is confusing because there's also Nokia, which is making wearables, but they're different Nokias.
So can you just clarify this, because the Nokia phone is not actually made by Nokia, right?
Except it is made by Nokia.
The Nokia kind of brand.
Yeah.
So these are not the people who designed the 3310.
Except they are. So this is where it gets slightly confusing.
So confused.
HMD, the Finnish company that bought the Nokia brand from Microsoft. So Microsoft bought Nokia's devices division a few years ago, absolutely tanked it, ruined it, and then decided that, okay, well, we can make a bit of money back. So they sold it to HMD. HMD is almost a spin-out of what remained of Nokia that Microsoft didn't buy. So most of the people that worked on the engineering and the design and the development of this Nokia phone and the other Nokia phones that were announced at Mobile World Congress are actually former Nokia employees. The two people that I went to a briefing with both used to work for Nokia proper. So it's weird. But they also announced the Nokia 6, 5 and 3, nice simple names, all cost less than €230, have a very high-end look and feel, made of nice metals and very polished edges, very small bezels, things to get excited about. The big selling point, which you wouldn't think would be a big selling point, is that they run completely untouched versions of Android. And anyone that's used HTC or Samsung or Sony Android phone might have the complaint that, why is there all these Samsung apps that do the same as the Google apps? I have two calendar applications, four messaging applications, all this weird Samsung stuff that I never use. So Nokia's trick is, well, we're just going to leave it alone. So these are essentially budget Pixels, which is the phone made by Google. And Android is now a wonderful operating system. It doesn't need device manufacturers to preload it with bloatware. So it could be a useful killer app.
See, that sounds, I'm intrigued by that. I think the 3310, someone made a great point on Twitter that the 3310, the new 3310, I should say, can't even run kind of WhatsApp.
Yeah.
And those kind of apps, which are huge in kind of emerging markets where Nokia phones are really popular. But as you say, like, Android is so filled with bloatware and in a lot of models that becomes quite a strong selling point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So they're good phones. They're very well made, they're very well engineered, and they're very well priced. So that was exciting to see. The other phone companies did less good things. Sony announced the XZ Premium, which has a 4K HDR display. Now, Sony already had a phone with a 4K display, so they now put HDR on it. And this is using some of the technology that's in Bravia Tellys. So HDR is high dynamic range, right? So if you've got a very fancy TV and you have a Netflix subscription, you might have watched Marco Polo, which was filmed in 4K HDR. Not a lot of stuff is at the moment, but where the content is available, you can now watch 4K HDR on your incredibly expensive premium Sony handset.
And I think they've signed a deal with Amazon to stream Prime content in 4K HDR as well.
So if you buy one now, you're going to be getting in a little bit ahead of the curve. Another way of putting it is you won't have anything to watch other than sort of promotional videos and Marco Polo, and I think maybe House of Cards is the new ones being filmed in 4K HDR.
Yeah, HDR is kind of the new kind of buzzword in both filmmaking and kind of screen technology, right?
Really nice.
You get these presentations with people kind of showing charts about how black the blackest blacks on their displays are, and Hollywood is very excited about this. IMAX, like the new IMAX laser cinemas and things, are kind of pushing HDR as one of the big selling points of their new big production thing. Mm-hmm. So you're going to hear more and more about it, and I think eventually, like 4K, everything will be HDR.
It makes sense.
It's nice to see this kind of coming through.
Jeremy White, our product editor, said this phone is probably going to have a better screen resolution and quality of being able to display stuff than actually a lot of people's TVs because of the quality of what it can actually play, even though there's not that much content available for it. So
yeah,
better than your TV.
And the really neat thing about 4K HDR, without wanting to harp on about it too much, is in an era when there's lots and lots of big comic book movies coming out and they've kind of got lots of bright colors but also lots of gloomy, dark, apocalyptic stuff, it really, really makes the brightness of the costumes or explosions or whatever it is stand out against the darkness of everything else going on around it. So it's sort of like a Christopher Nolan film.
Yeah,
it looks
so you
amazing.
Can see Batman in Batman versus Superman.
Right.
As opposed to just a shadowy blob.
Is that him there?
With Ben Affleck's voice.
Are they bat ears? I can't quite see. LG announced the LG G6 with Dolby Vision. Again, the phone tries to mimic TV technology, but does it in a slightly different way. But it's a trend, so much as there was a trend at Mobile World Congress. So there was that. Matt, you weren't there, but you were doing a lot of reporting from the office. What caught your eye?
Samsung, actually, who didn't really do well. They announced a couple of tablets, but traditionally at Mobile World Congress, Samsung announced the latest in their Galaxy line. So I think last year they did the Galaxy S7 and the Galaxy
Note.
Galaxy
Note. Oh yes.
Which is the one that exploded?
That was the one that was after that, which was the Note 7, the Galaxy Note 7.
Yep.
And they didn't actually announce anything this year in terms of mobile phones. But they said their next phone, which is going to be the S8, which will be its newest flagship phone after the one that caught fire and exploded, will be coming up at the end of March. But I would imagine that the delay in this, or not launching it at the same sort of time as they normally do, is probably because of the production problems and stuff and the issues and the reputational issues they had with the
They're probably
the
giving it a double, triple, quadruple check, imagine.
What caught my eye was nothing.
Yeah, that's a fair point. VR as one final thing. So HTC, there was also the Game Developers Conference this past week in San Francisco, and HTC was showing off a bunch of new VR stuff. Google's there, very heavy presence with its Daydream VR and an awful lot of other VR stuff alongside more conventional games. But HTC at Mobile World Congress had a demo of its new HTC tracker technology. They're these like pucks of plastic that you can fix to any part of your body to get another sort of point of reference for the tracking. So in the demo I played, it was a remake of a game that's been around for a while called Island 359, which is essentially Dino Crisis in VR, if people know the game from the PlayStation in the late 90s. So you slip one tracker on each foot and one tracker on your belt, and that then means that your feet and your waist are tracked in VR very accurately, so you can then go and kick velociraptors in the face.
That's you should have led with that. I just wanted to say that was when you told me that you were kicking raptors in the face, I was like, ooh.
Interesting.
I'm sold already.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a lot of VR games. It's super arcadey, it's a bit glitchy, it makes you feel a little queasy, but being able to, and it takes a little bit to kind of to get over how weird you feel doing it. But once you get into it a little bit, it's kind of fun, but it still has the problem that you have a cable coming out the back of your head. And when you're kicking and twisting and turning, you become very aware of the cable. So the tech is kind of cool as a demo, but when each of these trackers costs an extra £100 potentially, so you've got £100 on each foot, £100 on your mid-rift, you're wearing the headset, there's a new sound, nice sort of headphone system that's a bit less clunky than wearing big noise-cancelling ones. You've got to have the computer, the sensors. So we're talking, like, I don't know, £2,000.
So when this week Oculus dropped its prices for the Rift and the touch controllers in the UK, this is presumably a little bit why, right? The yeah. entry point, the cost to get into VR at the moment is just so high.
Too high. And I think we ran a story a couple of weeks ago that Sony's PlayStation VR, they'd sold an unexpectedly large amount of them because they are cheaper. They're a bit easy. You don't need all this extra kit. And that's probably where they have the advantage, that and that people go PlayStation gaming. They don't necessarily go Oculus or HTC. So it's still very, very early days, and the tech demos are still kind of glitchy.
One more thing from the news this week. Matt, we were discussing the UK digital strategy kind of document which launched. Was there anything in there of that wasn't kind of just like the usual noise? It seemed like... So for those who don't know, this is the government's kind of been doing a review into digital strategy for the UK, and their essential finding is invest in coding, and also we don't know because of Brexit. But is that a fair assumption?
That's a pretty succinct assumption. So the policy, or the, well, it's not even a policy, the document around what is essentially a strategy and a way forward for the government in terms of everything digital came out. It was first proposed at the end of 2015 and then has just been delayed for ages until then. There's a lot of announcements around coding and getting Google and BT and people involved with new schemes to do that. But there was a lot of rehashing of old government policies in there as well. I think there was quite a few things that were announced previously but incorporated into the digital strategy. So yeah, not that much exciting in there.
I think my favorite line was, there was a line about the fact that we need to teach cyber. I don't really know what that is, but it sounds like a brilliant like line from a 1990s hacking film.
It's, we've got
like,
the best cyber. The best, yeah. Cyber, some of the best.
Well, as Donald Trump would say, maybe it's hardly doable.
So we could have finished the podcast on kicking velociraptors in the face, but we finished it on government digital strategy.
Kicking
Britain in the face. You can read about that and all of the other stories that we talked about on this week's podcast on wired.co.uk. I'll include the links on to all the stories on our podcast story on the site. So if you want to find them there, you can read everything that you'd need to know. And that's it. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much. See you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.